Welcome back to the USCHoops.com College Basketball Podcast. This is the September 22nd, 2022 edition. The USCHoops.com College Basketball Podcast is the original podcast covering the USC Trojans men's college basketball team and is available on such platforms as Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and TuneIn, as well as at the USCHoops.com website. If you haven't done so already, we really appreciate it if you gave us a five-star rating and left a review on the platform of your choice. This is your co-host, Chase, as always, joined by Nick. Nick, how are you doing?
Doing well, Chase. Good to be back, and don't have too much news to report, but we'll run through a few items here.
Yes. So I guess right off the bat, we should probably discuss the news that broke today, which seems in the scheme of things to be kind of potentially insignificant, but it's, if you know anything about college basketball recruiting, it's not. On3 is a now a competitor to 24/7 Sports and Rivals. And they're trying to, I think they've surpassed Rivals in terms of basketball coverage already. They have Jamie Shaw as one of their, you know, basketball, the recruiting analyst. How much of his background do you know about, Nick?
So they poached him from Rivals within the last like 6 months or so. And, you know, I read a little bit of his stuff at Rivals, and he's probably there for, you know, at least a year, I want to say, but definitely like a very plugged in guy.
Yeah. So, I mean, he has been, if you remember, I think we discussed this on the podcast last week. Maybe if we didn't discuss it, then we posted about it, but he had picked, he had done an article talking about Drew Fielder, essentially coming down to his college decisions. I think it was either him or Tipton, but it was very clear that Shaw was saying that Fielder was going to commit to Providence, and our collective reaction was, well, so much for USC, because when Shaw speaks on these things, he's like, I mean, his track record is, it's almost scary accurate. He is now, I think he did a tweet today claiming that he hit 70 of his last 70. I don't know if it's that good, if he's exaggerating, but I think his documentable track record is over 95% accurate, I believe.
Yeah, no, he's really good. And you have to be careful with some of this stuff too, because they can like change their picks last minute. So like, even if he's nailed like, you know, 95% plus, like if he had one school for a kid and then flip that last minute, does he really get credit for, you know, picking that recruitment correctly? Like, so there's, you know, a little bit of leeway there, but
yeah. And I don't know, I don't know the berth that On3 gives to their people to do that. They probably do. I know that it became an issue recently, 24/7, where you'd see these guys all changing their minds at the last second when it became clear exactly where a guy would go. But from what we've observed with Shaw, he's usually kind of the trailblazer. He's not just the follower. And we bring it up because he put in a crystal ball pick, or whatever their version of crystal ball pick is, for Isaiah Collier to go to commit to USC. Now, he only did it with a 75% confidence rate, which in the scheme of things isn't that high, considering that everyone already thinks Collier is already down to two schools anyway. But there are reasons to think that this is a very strong sign.
Yeah. And like one example of kind of Shaw's track record and strength is the Kwame Evans recruitment. So there was a time where it looked like Arizona was going to get him, and Shaw was saying, no, it's Oregon. And you had the national guys at 24/7, like Travis Branham at Arizona, Jason Shear at Arizona. And Jamie Shaw was right. Like, he was out on a limb, like the only, you know, guy that had Oregon. And then these other guys got tipped off last minute that it was Oregon. But like, that was an instance where Shaw had the scoop first. And that's not to bash like Branham. I think Travis Branham's a very good analyst, but it just kind of shows how plugged in Shaw is here.
Yes. Now, we should say this week there have been a couple other picks made, especially I think on Rivals, regarding Collier, and they picked Cincinnati. And I think one of them includes a guy who used to work as Rivals football, worked as the Rivals football site for Cincinnati. The site moderator for the biggest Cincinnati site is on 24/7, and his name is Chad
Brendel.
He has been very cautious in his language, his words. I think he's actually been kind of honest to just saying he's not sure where Collier is going. He has tried very hard to make inroads with the Collier family, had some communications, apparently doesn't have quite as many communications that he did before, but you can tell that he is very cautious about what he's saying, which tells me that the Cincinnati people do not have the affirmative in any way. They think it's still right. open, but they don't have an affirmative, someone telling them affirmatively, like on the Cincinnati staff, oh, we're going to get him. Whereas,
right.
and, yep. go ahead.
Oh, and I was just going to say, like, he definitely has a direct line to the Cincinnati coaching staff.
100%.
Like, he's getting all his info from the Cincinnati coaching staff side and not quite as much from the Collier family side, even though, like, as you mentioned, like, he has had prior communication in the past with those guys. But he is, in terms of the Cincinnati moderators, like, he's by far the most plugged in compared to these other rivals guys.
Yeah, and we try to be, I think we try to be careful in discussing these moderators, and they definitely come of different vintages when it comes to accuracy and integrity. And the Cincinnati guy, I have to say, there's nothing he's said at any time made me think, oh, this guy is just a windbag BSer type, just trying to drive. Yeah. He's, I think, trying to play this straight, He had some connections there. He clearly has connections with the staff, had some connections with the family. I think it's been tough because the family really tried to play close to the vest. So it's hard to get in and get that information. And he's just been honest. He's been like, look, anyone telling you that they know for sure, they don't. Now, I will tell you that when Shaw made this prognostication, it was on the heels of Andy Enfield visiting Atlanta to watch Collier and Arrington Page play. At that time, like right after Enfield was there, Collier went on Twitter, and that was either yesterday or the day before, and said, commitment date announced soon, something like that. Not that he was going to announce the commitment soon. He was going to announce the date of the commitment. And Tipton had an article that you just pointed me to. They dropped just an hour or two ago, and they discussed the timelines, and it still says November. So obviously SC would prefer this to happen quicker, especially since Collier will be making another visit to SC in October with Page.
Right. Yeah, that's my sense too. Page, I think, is definitely going to do it. I guess the wild card with the Page visit is he's got a Cincinnati visit next weekend, or I think it's this weekend, with Jizzle James, who's the other point guard that Cincinnati's recruiting. We talked about him on the last podcast. He's Edrin James's son, also from the Atlanta area. So, maybe Cincinnati absolutely blows Page away and he shuts it down, but that kind of seems unlikely at this point. So it does seem like they're going to get Collier and Page back on campus in October and probably before either are committed. That's my sense right now.
Chase, and when you say they, you mean USC is looking at them both. Yes.
Correct. Yep. Yep.
And I just a little more detail around, just to discuss here, there is a 2024 recruit named Flory Bidunga. He's like the number four overall player right now, I think, in the 2024 class per 247 Sports, and he is the top center. What's important there is he is talking about reclassifying to 2023 and committing to Cincinnati. Arrington Page has apparently made it very clear he does not want to play the five position in college. He wants to go somewhere where there's an established five man. Now, so this recruit would kind of be a signal, hey, we don't need you to play five. We've got a five. It gives USC, I don't think it matters that much because SC has got a lot of bigs that will still, unless they're, decide to leave early, will still be on the team by the time pages it would be lined up to come. So the combination of that and USC, apparently, I'm not sure exactly how we would describe what happened with Drew Fielder, but I really feel like if we were the ones pressing the hardest, you know, Fielder would have given us a harder look than it seemed to in the end. I mean, he committed at a time that I don't think he necessarily needed to, if he might have been interested in looking other places. That's nothing wrong with the Providence program. It's a, you know, it has performed very well in the last several years. It's Cooley is the Cooley, right, is the coach. He's done very well.
Yeah.
And so it's a well-coached program. They're successful. But you know, it is, you know, in Providence, Rhode Island, and here, this is a kid from, you know, from Idaho. So it seemed, who's playing for SoCal Academy. So it seemed like an odd destination, but that's what happens. I have a feeling that there is a thinking that we're going to get Paige. He and Fielder are both fours. They're not fives. And we don't want to stack our roster too full with fours if we're trying to get this Paige Collier combo. That's at least my thinking. And the last thing I'm going to say about this whole situation is I have heard from my source that there is positive feelings about Collier on our staff. And I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, that's a great way to cap it. I'll just make one more comment just on the Paige positional thing. Even if you have the sentiment of like, I want to play the four, USC like might be the easiest school in the country to sell. Like, oh, even if we make you a five, like you can still handle the ball and shoot threes, just because they had the track record with Evan Mobley doing that, right? So
yeah,
not that Paige is anywhere near Evan Mobley talent wise because he's not, but you could at least like showcase like that as a possible, you know, role and showing that they do give the bigs the freedom to do those sort of things.
Right. And look, and frankly, if you watch Paige play, at least my watching him, SC's roster right now, as it's currently constructed, and as we assume it would be constructed for next season, you wouldn't need Paige to play the five. I mean, there's plenty of other guys to fill that role at this stage. So, okay. So, you know, we've said a lot about that, and we talked, I mean, I think you and I were both eager for this Collier recruitment to come to an end. Now we hear November, and it's like, oh my goodness. Yes. I really hope it's not November, but whatever.
Yeah.
It ends when it ends. It to me, it just means that SC's probably, you know, unless Paige commits earlier, there could be a longer term period where SC still goes without any commits for the 2023 class.
Right.
UCLA now has two commits. They have obviously Devin Williams, who committed a few weeks back, and then just earlier this week, Brandon Williams. This is the year of the Williams, by the way, if you guys haven't noticed, because Cody Williams was on campus for USC this past weekend. Brandon Williams, who's kind of a four-man, you know, somewhat similar to Paige, committed to UCLA. So I think he's a pretty good recruit. I like him more than Devin Williams, quite a bit more. I think it's a kind of a player that Mick could really – he would have a guy like that at Cincinnati. Hasn't had that as much at UCLA. And I think he will fit in nicely over there. It sounds like the UCLA recruiting plan will be to try to get maybe one, or, you know, try to get Stojakovic and then maybe fill out the rest of the class with European players, interestingly enough. And Stojakovic, while himself is not technically European, obviously is – father was a European basketball player. So they're, you know, it's a little bit of a, and they brought in a European player over the summer too for the 2022 class. So it's a little bit of a different direction that they seem to be going now in recruiting, particularly when, you know, originally you had, you know, them looking at guys like Boswell and McCain, and now they're just on a kind of a completely different track.
Yeah, I think that's right. And they struck out with those guys, right? They struck out with Stromer. They struck out with Boswell and McCain. But they're still going to have a pretty nice class, especially if they get Stojakovic in here. So Kind of more like multi-year guys. I think with Brandon Williams, like you said, he's a 6'7", 205 kind of 3-4 combo forward, and can do a lot of things. Really good athlete, really young for his class too. So he's a pretty projectable player, even though he's a little bit raw from a skills standpoint. But I think he'll do well for UCLA. So yeah, if they can get a foreign kid and get Stojakovic with these two Williams guys, it's a good class. Like, they don't have that elite one and done player, I don't think, but those guys will win a lot of games at UCLA.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I mean, look, Stojakovic and Brandon Williams is a really nice foundation for a class, especially if you're going to say, okay, well, Devin Williams is a bit of a hood ornament type recruit now. We'll see what he can develop into. And these European players can, one of them might really hit well and be a huge upside player. So, yeah, it's a nice little recruiting class they're putting together there. It's not going to scare the bejesus out of you, but I think they can really build look, I mean, since Mick's gotten there, right, they've been really utilizing the same base of players that he inherited when he showed up. So, I mean, they've been tinkering here and there. They obviously have Amari Bailey and Adem Bona coming in for this upcoming class, but it's time to like start the transition, and they're going to have to transition into some new players. So all of that will be interesting. And just look, frankly, it's just not really, UCLA should be very strong this season, but they should not be strong next season. I mean, they're not going to have Tiger Campbell from everything we're hearing.
Jaime Jaquez,
and they're not going to have Amari Bailey, and they probably might not have Adem Bona either. So it's going to be a rebuilding. It's going to be a rebuilding year, and that's fine. Teams need to rebuild sometimes. Do you want to talk a little bit about the news on the NBA collective bargaining news that dropped this week?
Yeah, let's do it. Do you want to just preview it here and I can chime in?
Yeah, so there was initially a report that came out from somebody in The Athletic that said that the new collective bargaining agreement would go into place as early as 2023. And one of the provisions was going to be the elimination. Essentially, right now there's a 19-year-old age limit, a minimum age for the NBA. They were going to reduce that to 18 and then eliminate the one year of post high school requirement for American players. Now this is called the one and done rule, but really what it's not saying, all the rule really says is you have to spend 1 year after high school somewhere before going to the NBA. You need 1 year before you're eligible to go to the NBA. And it was implemented not to encourage one and dones, because one and dones will still be always available. It was done because so many kids were leaving directly out of high school and entering the NBA. And when this originally it started, early on, you're getting players like Kobe Bryant and Kevin Garnett, who are obviously Hall of Famers, and then Jermaine O'Neal. But over time, you started to get more and more players who were of more marginal quality. And I think and this was right around the same time that there was that infamous NBA final between the Nets and the Spurs. Now, that NBA final was not connected in any way to the one and done rule directly, but it was like the lowest rated, it's still to this day, the lowest rated non-pandemic final. It was lower rated than the finals we just had for the NBA. So it was coming on the heels of the Lakers Kobe Shaq dynasty ending. It was before before LeBron had left, had really even become a really big player in the NBA, and certainly before the Heat did their run. So I think there was concern at the time that they were watering down their league and ratings were already beginning to suffer. I actually have been, I know it's very controversial and everyone seems to hate the one and done rule. I think a lot of people think that this rule is causing one and dones. In reality, what it did was it stopped players from going to the NBA directly out of high school. I think it has been really great for both leagues. I think the NBA, until more of the pandemic and the political events that they've suffered through the last few years, they were doing, it was doing very, very well. And, you know, you had that period of time with the Warriors where they were drawing the best ratings that the NBA had had really since the Jordan era. So I think, and that team was built upon, you know, it was built upon guys who played in college. You know, Steph Curry being a great example of a kid who came out of nowhere, had one offer out of high school, was one of the greatest college basketball players we've seen. Klay Thompson was a tremendous, tremendous college basketball player in the Pac-10 that Tim Floyd decided to pass on. Thank you, Tim Floyd. But, you know, it was a team that was built that way. And it brought a lot of excitement to the NBA, a lot of fan appreciation. I think the rule has worked out very well. I know not everyone shares that opinion. So when this tweet came out, it sounded like, hey, this thing might finally be over. And we might now be seeing direct from high school coming again as early as the 2024 draft. However, that... Now, that would not have affected like Isaiah Collier because he's going to be eligible for the 2024 draft anyway, but it would affect the class afterwards. Those guys would be able to skip college entirely. Now, right after that, Adrian Wojnarowski seemed to sing a little bit of a different tune to clarify the earlier tweets to say, no, they're still talking about lowering the age limit to from 19 to 18, but... The straight out of, you still have to do 1 year after high school. That's not going to change, which is interesting. And then he said, if it did change, it would not be implemented until several years down the road because teams have already been trading future draft picks. And we know that to be the case. If anyone who follows the NBA, they go crazy trading future draft picks. Right now, there's a deal being held up apparently for the Indiana Pacers to take on the contract of Russell Westbrook because they're insisting on getting two Lakers first round picks for 2027 and 2029. Now I realize we're already in 2022, but those are, you know, 5 and 7 years down the road, draft picks. So anyway, I've said a mouthful. It does not sound like the rules will be changing for college anytime soon, but there at least was out there for a while and people have different thoughts on that. So do you have any thoughts? And it still could get implemented.
Yeah, I mean, I like the idea of kids being able to go from high school to the NBA just because, like, I, you know, support the player freedom and their ability to, you know, make their own decisions. But I do agree, like, just practically it, you know, has worked out well for both college and the NBA having the one and done. And look, I don't think it's like hurt college basketball at all for players to play a year and then go. I mean, it's not like, you know, like I've really enjoyed like these Kentucky teams. Some of the elite ones have been really fun to watch. Same with Duke, and they don't win every year either, right? So I think you get a lot of parity in the sport, and then you get to see these talents for a year. But then, like, if you miss on the talents, like it's not the end of the world. You know, you can build competitive college basketball teams without having one and done players. And in fact, like Villanova is often considered the gold standard of the sport, even though they have very few one and dones that go there. So yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. Like you said, it doesn't seem to be in the works in the near future. And there's always noise about this sort of thing. And they were thinking about doing it and having the 2020 class be able to go none and done. And then that never happened. And then you got to have the G League thing pop up. So I'm kind of always skeptical, like every time you hear these reports, because it's hard to know like whether it's legitimate or not. And I know from the NBA side as well, like they like the one and done, a lot of these, you know, owners, because they have the extra year to scout players, right? Like, you know, you could see Scott Labissiere have the not so good year at Kentucky, and then he fell in the draft. But if you had the none and done era, he probably would have gone, you know, top three in that draft and been a total bust for whatever franchise picked him. So, yeah, I mean, I said a lot there, but I guess my takeaway is I would support getting rid of it, but totally agree with you that it has worked out well for both sides practically.
Yeah, I think, and I think as I look, I think you can look at this as a kind of just you know, free market side, like it makes sense right. to let them play. Yeah. On the other hand, I always say this is a counter to that. It would be a mistake to think that personnel decisions in the NBA are a free market. They're not. If there was a free market, there would be no draft at all. Players would just correct. Sign.
Yeah.
Players would just sign wherever they wanted to. And yeah. Contracts would not be governed by collective bargaining agreements. They'd be governed by just bilateral negotiations with the individual player and then figuring out what are the terms they want to agree to. And there right. would be no, salary cap. There'd be no luxury tax. Right. You yeah. know, and the result would be that the Lakers would win the championship, you know, every other year. And, yep. you know, maybe some owner would be willing to spend a ton of money. And then, you know, 26 of the 30 teams probably not be competitive. All those things are put into place that are not free market right. are put into place because it's, you know, considered better for the competitiveness of the league as a whole, overall revenue. And yeah, it is. It is a collusion. It's collusion by absolutely. Supposedly competitive organizations, but it's collusion to increase the whole of the pie. And, you know, that's the way I kind of, you know, think about these things. What else? There's going to be one other thought I had on this, and I don't even know if it's important, but yeah, we'll see how. Oh, I guess the other thing is that just as from a spectator standpoint, you know, there's so many players that have really intriguing college careers, but they might only last one or two seasons, and then they're drafted into the NBA, even high draft picks, and I never hear from them again. Now, partially that's my fault because I just don't spend a lot of time following like small market teams in the NBA, and sometimes these players end up there. But it's just like there are players that are really good that you just never see play if you don't get a chance to see them in college. And that's one of the reasons I like seeing them on a personal selfish basis. And I think as it's just a basketball fan, but okay, that's that. Let's talk a little bit about football.
Yeah.
Because there's not a ton of basketball news right now. As we've kept saying, last week we picked some games or kind of talked about some games. Let's save SC here for last. Let's talk about, where I messed up. I said, I thought, Texas San Antonio was going to beat Texas outright. It looked like I might be super prescient there for about a half. And then my prediction fell apart. Texas won not easily enough that they actually covered. They won by 21. You know, I don't know what that means going forward. You know, I'm curious to see. I'm still skeptical of Texas. You know, maybe they'll have a super dynamite year, but I still think they're probably going to lose three or four games at least.
Yeah, they've got like a good amount of talent, but you know, once they start playing the Baylors and the Oklahomas and the Oklahoma States, you know, it feels like they have at least two more losses in them.
Yeah. I don't think we really talked about Penn State Auburn. Maybe we should have talked about that game. Penn State won that for fun. That's interesting. It was competitive for about a half. The game was in Auburn, so you don't really see a ton of Big Ten teams going down regular season games into SEC country and winning so handily. I mean, that's not something that normally happens. So, but it did. And I guess one of the other games that that I think is funny is the other great mesh run pass option offense, Wake Forest. Did hold on to win by 1 point against Liberty. So yep. I'm not 100% sure that this mesh run pass option is quite the scariest thing in the world.
Yeah, that was kind of a crazy game. I watched a little bit of the end of it, and like Liberty, they were down 7 with under a minute to play. I had like a 4th and long, and basically they had the quarterback rolled out, threw a jump ball in the end zone that was tipped up and then caught by the Liberty player for a touchdown. And they went for 2 and missed. So,
yeah. And not a great going for 2 call, in my opinion.
Oh, horrific.
Yeah. Horrific call. So, the decision to do it, I don't mind, but the actual play they came up with was, Not the greatest.
It was a slow developing reverse to the short side of the field with like a slow receiver running the
right ball, yes, basically. And there was a potential for an option to pass it, but that didn't really, there's no real players open or anything like that in case that was even considered. Okay, so Texas A&M bounces back, beats Miami. I think Texas A&M, I think I predicted them to win that game, but I think they're going to be like a 8-4 team is my guess. Something leading along that. I don't, maybe they'll still have the number one recruiting class again next year. Big game for the Pac, big game for the Pac-12. Washington, now the final score was a little bit closer, but you know, the Michigan State, ranked number 11, came up to Seattle. Washington, coming off a really tough year, have brand new head coach from Fresno State, and they were really running it up on Sparty there. And final margin was 11 points, but Washington looked good.
They did. They've got a good quarterback. It's Michael Penix Jr. came over from Indiana, and he won some big games in the Big Ten. He beat Penn State 1 year. So he's a good player, and they look pretty good, I think, defensively from like a speed standpoint. I mean, Michigan State's always been kind of a phony with Mel Tucker. Like, they've gotten ridiculously lucky in a lot of these games. And there's a reason Washington's laying 3.5, even though they were the non-ranked team. And
right.
But I think Washington's like a legit top 20 team this year. So they look pretty good.
They look pretty good. And we'll see. I mean, some teams are gonna catch up with them, and the 3-0, if they can get to 8-4, I think that's a good season. 9-3 would be a home run for them. Okay, the nuclear reactor game. Utah beat San Diego State handily. You've heard about this story, right? This is just an amazing story to me. First of all, it was like a female student. It's a girl who in Yip Yap, which Yip Yap is that there? What Yik Yak? What is the name of this app?
I don't know.
I don't even know this. I've heard of it before. I've never known anyone who actually uses it, but she apparently in the app said, if Utah doesn't beat San Diego State, I'm going to detonate the nuclear reactor. So apparently, Utah's got probably on one of their science campus has a nuclear reactor on campus. She apparently attends classes in the same building where the nuclear reactor is located. This comment was treated like seriously enough that not only did she get arrested, but it's like a news story. I mean, as if she had it, like if you were in the presence of a nuclear reactor, other than like, messing with it, like you'd have any idea to actually detonate it. I mean, maybe you could cause like some sort of radioactive leak, but it's just amazing to me that this is considered like a serious thing. Like the things we consider serious now and like don't consider serious, it's just like, it's since when I was young, I'm an old man now, but just things kind of like turned on their head. When I was in the 90s, right around the time that Al Pacino changed his persona as an actor into this like loudmouth Al Pacino that I think a lot of people recognize him for now, not the Al Pacino, the Godfather. He did a movie called Son of a Woman that was like really kind of displayed that transition. And there's this famous scene at the end of the movie where he says, he's talking, it's like this assembly of a private all boys school in New England, and all the students are there. And this one student is being essentially coerced into ratting on his fellow students. And Al Pacino's character is sitting there to defend him. And Al Pacino says, if I was half the man I was 5 years ago, I'd take a flamethrower to this place. Now, that was actually a very specific type of threat where he was going to take a flamethrower. Nobody seemed to actually take that seriously. I mean, the character was blind. But like to me, that actually is far more serious, like a terrorist threat. Like they're say you're going to detonate the nuclear reactor. Because the football team doesn't beat San Diego State. Anyway, any thoughts on the nuclear reactor?
I just laughed when I heard it. It's just the era of social media just amplifies these things. And, you kind of see how like ridiculous some of this stuff is, but I thought it was great. Just, I got a good laugh out of it.
Yeah. Okay. Speaking of funny, BYU's performance at in Eugene, not exactly a stellar performance. That game against Baylor the week before had been a super ugly game, and BYU won it, but they looked ugly against Oregon. So Oregon looks like, hey, maybe we're better than we looked in week one. You have any thoughts on this one?
Yeah, no, I was dead wrong on this. Oregon basically just out-athleted them. And it's hard to know, like, if Landon can coach at all, right? Because he's had, like, kind of two marquee games. One, he got out-athleted, and the other, he out-athleted the other team. But, you know, I still think the jury's out whether he can coach at all. So that'll be interesting to follow. I think they'll do pretty well in the Pac-12 North, like, kind of 8-4, 9-3-ish this year is my sense.
I think that sounds right. Maybe I think they'll do 9-3, just knowing Oregon, they'll probably do 9-3. Yeah. You know, the conference usually folds to them. Okay, SC. Interesting game against Fresno State. Obviously, you know, Fresno State loses some key players to injury, but the backups didn't actually seem to perform too poorly. What was interesting to me was the offense was really clunky, and Caleb Williams did not have a good game. He missed some reads. He missed some open players. And yet, SC won pretty handily. 28-point win against, I think, a pretty decent Fresno State team. I know they've lost twice now, but I think they could win the rest of their games, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I know even with their backup quarterback, I know they're going to be shorthanded now. So this was, like, to me, I know at certain points the Stanford game, especially the first half, we looked great. But this game really told me a lot, because it said, okay, look, the defense obviously has huge issues, but the offense is of such a quality that even when it looks clunky and the quarterback is not executing at the level he's capable of, it still puts the points on the board. It just takes more plays to do it. And that's what we saw. And look, there would have been more points on the board in the first half if Lincoln Riley kind of relented and just started running the ball more. I think he was really trying to keep up the pass offense as long as possible, trying to get things in line. And the second half, you know, they let the guys run and it was just too much. So I don't know. What are your thoughts on SC Fresno State?
I thought the O-line really stood out. I mean, like, when was the last time you saw, like, an SC team blow people off the ball like they have been so far, right?
No, well,
it's been great.
Yeah, and I think, look, I cannot stress this enough. It's so important. When you put the defense, like, on roller skates, on making them defend the entire field, not knowing where players are going, it makes it so much easier for the offensive line. I can't say that enough. And that was a huge issue with really our last three coaches, but in particular, you know, Clay these last several years.
Yeah, no, that's right. Even, like, Caleb's legs I thought were really impactful, right? He had the zone read keepers on 4th-and-1. Those are really important because, you know, they would run those under Helton, but the quarterback would never keep the ball. So, like, you're basically, every time you do that, you're giving the defense an extra player, essentially, right? So, yeah, I think that's really key. And the running backs are, like, legit good, especially Dye. I mean, Dye's, like, individual effort on that one, like, long run that he scored on was really impressive in terms of his tackle breaking ability. Jones is solid. Like, he's a solid player, but he doesn't have the kind of it factor that I think Dye does. So, but yeah, like, O-line's really good. Like, they're veteran and they still have a bunch of 4-stars on the line. So when, you know, when you've got 4th- and 5th-year kids that are, you know, 4-stars and of quality, like, you can see these kind of performances. So I'm really curious to see, is that just a fluke because they played poor, like, front sevens, or if there's something more to that. I think that'll probably determine a lot of how good the offense is, but so far I've been pretty impressed. And look, even that Rice team that they beat week one, they've, like, totally blown out the spread in their next two games. So they played McNeese State. They won by 42 when they were favored by 10. And then they were 10-point underdogs against Louisiana Lafayette, and they won that game by 12. So not that Rice is any great shakes, but they're clearly overperforming. And, you know, they've got some talent on offense. So it's not a total disaster that they happen to move the ball a little bit early on there.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go over some games for this week, and you just tell me your thoughts. We got, I guess it's worth mentioning only because they're one of the top offenses in the country, which is Maryland. They're going to the Big House to play Michigan, 17-point line. I like Michigan to cover. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think Michigan wins and covers. Maryland, I don't believe in them as a program.
Okay. Oregon heading over to the Palouse to play the Cougars. This is game 1 p.m. Pacific time on Fox. Oregon 7-point favorites. I actually think this is an interesting opportunity for the Cougars to this is a different kind of Cougar team, you know, so it's not a Mike Leach team really, but this might be an interesting game for the Cougars to pull an upset. I don't know if they'll get it done. I do think the line is about right, though. I think this could be a very close game.
Yeah, I'll take Washington State to cover here. I think they have probably a 50-50 shot at winning outright. They're really good defensively. Like they've given up 17 and then 14 at Wisconsin and 7 against Colorado State. So, you know, when you have a really good defensive team, points are even more valuable. I think their quarterback is good enough. He's competent. So, you know, they should be able to, I think, score probably like 21, 24 points on Oregon. So I'll take the Cougars to cover, then maybe get it done outright.
Okay, what are your thoughts on this? Is a 9 a.m. game, Pacific time, 11 a.m. Central, noon Eastern, Clemson at Wake Forest, Clemson 7-point favorite.
That line just seems like exactly right. I guess I'll take Clemson to cover on the road.
I'm gonna take Clemson to cover. I think if Clemson does not win and cover this game, then Dabo maybe is the dynasty might be over. I mean, I don't want to be overly dramatic, but like, you know, we're giving him a mulligan on last season. But this is a game, you know, if you're gonna still dominate the ACC, you got to win and cover this game, you know, because Wake Forest ranked, everybody knows what they're in store for. 12:30 Pacific, 3:30 Eastern, Florida at Tennessee, historic rivalry. Tennessee actually 10.5 point. I can't remember the last time Tennessee was such a big favorite against Florida. I don't know what to think about this one.
I'll take Florida. I think Tennessee, like, you know, they've been getting a lot of hype this year, but I don't think that Pitt team that they beat was actually very good. Pitt struggled with West Virginia, who then turned around and lost to Kansas. So I know Kansas is supposed to be better this year, but it's still not a good performance by them. No, Florida's been struggling lately. They lost that game to Kentucky, but I think Kentucky's pretty good and then had that underperformance against South Florida. But 10.5 is a lot of points in a rivalry game, and I think they have a lot of team speed still. So I'll take Florida to cover and probably lose a close one.
Yeah, I'll take Florida cover. I think they might pull this one out. I'm just not, you know, not as sure. Okay, might as well mention Texas because we talked about Texas. Texas at Texas Tech. Texas 7-point favorites. I picked against Texas last week. I'm going to do it again. I'm picking Tech here. I think Tech will win.
Yeah, I can definitely see it. I'll take Tech too and the points. Their crowd will be really ready for Texas. There's a lot of hatred between the Texas fans and the Texas Tech fans. Like, they had that basketball game in Austin, and Texas Tech like traveled well and kind of like took over a big part of that arena. So, you know, they'll be ready. They'll have the crowd advantage, and they'll have a lot of motivated kids who wanted to play at UT. So, yeah, that's a good pick. I think Tech has a really good shot to get it done too.
All right, so here's an interesting one. Arkansas, which is now 3-0, pulled out kind of a bit of a heartbreaking game last week. What was that game that they almost?
It's Missouri State.
Right? Missouri State. Yeah.
Yeah.
But they won it at the end. They're a 2-point dog at Texas A&M. I like Arkansas here, but I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I do too. I think they win and cover. I guess if they win, they're covering, right?
Yeah,
no, they win, they're covering. Yeah. No, I think Arkansas's good. Like, they, you know, obviously didn't play their best last week, but before that, like, they had that win over Cincinnati, which is pretty impressive, I think. And they're a team with Sam Pittman. Their head coach is an O-line guy. They've had really good trench plays. So I think they can kind of match A&M in the trenches, which I don't think Miami was really able to do. And A&M's offense, they've struggled, and you know, they made the quarterback change and he still wasn't that good last week, even though they beat Miami. So I guess, like, long story short, I think that Miami team is pretty fraudulent, so I wouldn't put too much stock in that A&M game last week and think they're like back or anything like that. So I think Arkansas is just better, quite frankly.
That's what I think too, and we'll see if we're proven right. Okay, so worth mentioning, Wisconsin at Ohio State, 18.5 points. Anything interesting about this game? You think Ohio State wins for fun, or will Wisconsin make a game of it?
I'll take Wisconsin to cover. I think Ohio State, they've just been fed up so much in these first few weeks. I think they finally covered last week, but 19 points just seems crazy. You know, with a Wisconsin team that's been pretty good, you know, year in, year out. I know they lost that game to Wazoo this year, but they've got enough talent on that roster and a few NFL players to make me think that like 19 is kind of insane. But what do you think?
I think it might be right on the money here.
Yeah.
You know, I don't like picking this one because I actually think this is probably a good range for what the score is probably going to be. Maybe Ohio State wins by 17, but I think they'll win by 2 touchdowns at least. Okay. Utah, the you know, nuclear detonator team, now has okay. We didn't even talk about this. And this is right down the street from me, literally, because I live in Tempe, Arizona. Herm Edwards is no longer the coach in Arizona State. I still can't believe he was ever the coach in Arizona State. He actually didn't perform that poorly. But he's not the coach anymore after losing to Eastern Michigan last week. I never heard of Eastern. Of the directional schools in Michigan, like, Eastern Michigan's always the one, like, you never hear them do anything in football or basketball, you know?
Yeah, they're the worst one.
Yeah, by far, right? Yeah, right? You know, I don't even know if I knew are they the Eagles? I didn't even know if I knew the team nickname. I mean, that's how...
I think they're the Eagles, but I'm only like 70% sure on that. So
And they lose that. It's hard to believe they, you know, and I guess they made it close to the end, but it wasn't always close the entire time. Yep. Utah's coming to town. You know, it's interesting. Utah will sometimes lose games like this. Arizona State's, you know, Herm is gone. Maybe the team rallies. It's a night game. I don't know what the fan turnout's going to be. That's an interesting thing. I've definitely been to that stadium where, I mean, that stadium can very much be like a big time party atmosphere in the stands as well. I don't know if that will be the case for this game. It's, you know, it starts 7:30 local time here. So it's going to, you know, people will be asleep on the East Coast. 15.5 points. I mean, Utah will win, I assume. I think Arizona State covers, though.
Yeah, I would lean ASU, but this also feels like the game where, like, Utah's up 21-0 at the end of the first quarter and you immediately regret it. So kind of like that Nebraska game last week, right? They were playing Oklahoma.
Right.
With the, you know, interim coach, and they looked kind of competitive early on and then just got blitzed. So I guess I would lean ASU, but it's hard to feel great about it.
Yeah. Well,
Chase, what do you think, too, about who's the least competent athletic department between ASU, Cal, and Stanford? They seem to be duking it out at the top right now.
Okay, so, right, that's a good question.
Colorado, too, they have to be thrown in the mix, right?
Yeah, so at least Colorado has a very competent basketball team and coach, right? So at least you can get them credit for that. Obviously, the hiring of Carl Durrell is probably the single worst hiring of all the hirings, including Herm Edwards, maybe even including Joaquin Jones. I mean, it was like a really, really bad hire. And it's showing. Boy, is it showing. I'm going to go with Cal for overall incompetence, just because you can make the argument for ASU, but I think they just got suckered by Herm. You know, Bobby Hurley is not great shakes, but he's not like some disaster. You know, whereas, you know, what Cal's done with their basketball team is just really shockingly terrible. And then there's just no resources going into football. I think Cal's the worst, but I'm definitely open to other arguments, and Arizona State's definitely got their points in their favor.
And maybe it's my like Colorado bias here, but I think they're like a serious contender actually here. Well, ASU firing Herm on the field was pretty hilarious too. Did you see that? There was a
Yes, I
clip
did.
and
Yes.
yeah, that was amazing. You know, not to mention like Michael Crow, you know, promoting Ray Anderson to AD was a disaster at ASU, and him backing Larry Scott was a complete disaster for the conference. But Colorado, I mean, these guys, they released a statement like after they got just boat raced by Minnesota, saying that, like, yeah, Karl Durrell's our coach, and I know we haven't performed up to expectations, but you should still come to support the kids. So I don't know like who consulted them to release that statement, but it's just insane to do, right? Like they're probably going to go 0-12 this year. I don't see another win on that schedule right now. And like, you know, it's not like you can give them credit for basketball per se, right? Because Tad Boyle's just been there, right? So all they've had to do
Yeah,
is
that's
just
a
stick with their
legacy,
coach.
right? That's actually it's did Mike Bone hire him or did he inherit him as well?
That's a good question. I think Bone may have hired him. I think, right, there you go. Mike Bone's looking pretty good, like all of a sudden, right? Like he's had the Boyle hire, he had the Fickell hire at
Yeah.
Cincinnati, and then the Lincoln Riley hire. I mean, you know, talk about a guy who's really turned around his reputation in the last couple of years here. It's kind of
Yeah,
crazy.
no kidding. Okay. Oh, I'd ask this to other people, because you brought up Colorado. What do you think is more likely? I think I asked you this offline too. What is more likely? Georgia loses a game, regular season, mind you, not including SEC title game, or Colorado wins a game.
So I think all the math would tell you to say it's more likely that Georgia loses a game, but I've talked myself into it's Georgia is more likely to go undefeated in my mind than Colorado is to win a game. I think I'm there. What do you
Okay,
think?
I completely agree. So let's go through the let's go through the Georgia schedule, what they got left on the schedule here. They have Kent State this weekend. After that, they have Missouri, Auburn at home. I don't think any of these get Vandy, not competitive. Florida at home. I don't think this Tennessee at home. I the toughest game they've got on their schedule is Kentucky. So it's hard. It's going to be hard to any for them to lose any of those games. By the same token, now we're going to talk about Colorado, because I don't like I see like you said I don't see a win on the schedule. Okay, so they got UCLA this weekend, and we didn't mention that game, but the game is in Boulder. UCLA is going to win that. I don't see it as any possible way. At Arizona, Arizona will win that. Home hosting Cal, that's a possibility. It's a possibility they could beat Cal. Will they? I don't think so. At Corvallis, loss. Home against the Sun Devils. That's the best. That's the target right there. Can they beat Arizona State? Then after the
That's
last
it.
four games of the season, Oregon, USC, Washington, and Utah, four ranked teams currently. They're not, I mean, I don't see them winning that. You know what? Like, I'm going Colorado 0-12, Georgia 12-0.
And I read that I think Durrell's agent took Rick George the cleaners on the contract negotiation. So I think they just cannot afford to buy him out. He's
Oh
got like
God,
not he's got like a fully guaranteed like 9 million left over the next couple of years.
that
So
is unbelievable,
even
unbelievable.
though
Okay,
like he had no leverage, right? Like no one was gonna hire him.
well, that's like the Clay Helton, same thing, you know. Like, okay, one more game before we get to SC. Stanford at Washington. Huskies at home, 13.5 point favorites. Look, my take on this, I'm not going to become some like Stanford homer all of a sudden, but I don't think Washington is quite as good as they looked early in the game against Michigan State. Stanford is not as good as they looked at good times during the SC game, but you know, so I think Washington wins this game, but I think it's more like a 10-point game is my guess.
Yeah, I actually agree with that. I think Stanford keeps it competitive. I think they probably have more NFL players than Washington. And I kind of think, like, you know, because USC is, they were a little underrated to start the year. Like, teams after playing USC, like, Rice covered two straight games relatively easily. And Stanford, like, we don't know because they had a bye last week how they're going to look after the SC game. But yeah, they had like a bye, you know, they're coming out of a bye, and SC is looking pretty tough. So yeah, I think, like, if Stanford wins this game, I wouldn't actually be totally shocked.
Yeah, I wouldn't either. Okay. USC, Oregon State, 5.5 point line in Corvallis. Couple notes about this game. The stadium, Reser Field, is going through renovation. So they've like torn down the stands on one side of the field. So there's only like, it only holds 26,000 people, which is going to be super strange. I'm sure the smallest venue SC's played in a long, long time. I've watched quite a bit of Oregon State. They, you know, Jonathan Smith does a lot of the little things that Oregon State did when Dennis Erickson was the coach and he was the quarterback, and some of the things that they did when Mike Riley was the coach. Not as well as when Riley was the coach. They had a, you know, they would do some of those end around offense. You know, that was, they were really, really good at that. They can still do some of it. And it really killed SC in the past. I'm not sure it's quite as good now. They operate a lot out of shotgun though. And, you know, they have some pretty, pretty efficient offense. You know, the Fresno, that game against Fresno State, the weekend before this past one, those teams really looked evenly matched. I mean, that was a real coin flip of a game. So I think they're basically on that level as a team. Fresno State outgained them by like 100 yards in that game, and missed several. I mean, they had to settle for field goal attempts like on three different occasions where they could have put the game out of reach, but they didn't. And they couldn't convert. If SC can convert in those situations against Oregon State, I think SC will win comfortably. But if they don't, if they run into the same problem, get down the field and then have to settle for field goal attempts, that's where this game could potentially come and become interesting. And maybe, you know, if Oregon State were to jump out to an early lead, SC could be in trouble. That's just kind of my high level analysis here. Otherwise, I think SC is a team that is looking better by the week and should win this game. But, you know, I never take anything for granted when you go up to Oregon.
Yeah, I like SC to cover. They're one of the few teams that have covered all 3 weeks. And I think all three of those covers have been pretty handily. I guess the lone exception is that Stanford game, but that was a game they dominated and kind of took their foot off the gas. Just looking at it from like a, you know, each side of the ball perspective, Hayner was much better against Oregon State than SC, right? Like, pretty clearly. He threw for 360. He was only 10 of 18 against SC. And then like Fresno also ran on Oregon State. I mean, they're running back at 21 carries for 122 yards, 5.8 yards per carry. So they were pretty effective on both sides. They scored 32 points. So, you know, they had a much more impressive performance against Oregon State's defense than USC's defense. I think that's pretty notable. And then I think you'd clearly take USC's offense against Oregon State's offense, right? Like, USC's offense is top five in the country. Even Chance Nolan, he was, you know, 14 of 27. He did have 8.1 yards per attempt. So, you know, maybe through like, you know, intermediate and deep passes, that was why his completion percentage was kind of on the lower side. But, you know, he had a lot of success running against USC. He only had 4 carries for -9 against Fresno State. So I think that's something the better coaches at SC compared to last year's staff can adjust for. So you'll have to be careful with this one, but it kind of seems like the game where like everybody is talking about it as an upset. So, you know, they're not really sneaking up on USC. So I kind of like SC to win and win relatively easily here.
The one stat from the Oregon State Fresno State game that I really, after watching kind of the highlights of the game again, because I watched it in real time, but kind of lost track of it because it was up against BYU Baylor. Going back watching a second time and then reviewing the stats, the one that really stuck out to me was punts. Fresno State punted twice in that game, both in the second half. Otherwise, it was very similar to like, you know, in our games were just teams, you know, we don't force teams to punt and we never punt. It was very similar from that. Oregon State, on the other hand, punted five times. Fresno State was able to stop them. But what happened was at the end of the game, Oregon State hit some big plays and was able to get scores when they needed to at the very end, at a time, quite frankly, where Fresno State, if they had converted earlier in the game would have been put out of reach. So because they failed to put the game out of reach at the end, they were susceptible for Oregon State coming in and kind of stealing the game at the very end, which is really what happened. So look, you got to give credit for Oregon State for doing that. They're playing on the road. They came from behind. They won. But on the field itself, for most of the game, you would say, look, Fresno State was the superior team as far as, you know, who had the better performance of on offense, on defense compared to Oregon State. And
I'll make a few other quick comments here too. So you probably noticed this too, but the Fresno State like red zone offense was really bad. I mean, they had six field goal attempts to Oregon State zero. Their kicker missed two field goals and their kicker also missed an extra point. So like plenty of opportunities to either, if they punched it in like one more time, they would have won. If the kicker would have made one more field goal and the extra point, they would have won. Right. So, you know, on a net yards per play basis, as you were saying here, they were superior, right? The other note too is Oregon State's tight end, who had five catches for 80 yards in that game, is out. So they're kind of down a big weapon too. And okay. I feel like no one's talking about that. So.
Yeah. Well, look, I think we both made the picks there. I think SC will cover. I know you think SC will cover. We'll see. Yeah. We'll see. But, you know, this rounds out a pretty – overall, pretty tough September for SC. So if they're able to come out 4-0 in Lincoln Riley's debut, that's something. It's, you need to discuss it. Clay Travis did his top 10 this week. He does it strictly on the basis of a games won on the field. So it's a little bit of a, you know, kind of gives you a skewed view of things, but he had USC number two after Georgia just based upon performance. And you kind of see where that would make sense, because SC has beaten Stanford and beaten Fresno State. And we'll see if they can keep it going with this Oregon State.
Yeah, all right. I'll make one more comment too, just like big picture. I mean, if they can get through this one, the schedule sets up really well for them, right? Yes. They've got that ASU home game's a bye game, right? And then they've got Wazoo at home. It's just hard to see them losing that. And then they've got obviously like the marquee game in Salt Lake City, which is going to be a, you know, big time game, but certainly winnable, right? They'll probably be favored. And yeah, then you've got the landmine in Arizona, which should be able to get through. And then Cal and Colorado at home are like easy games. And then UCLA road and Notre Dame home look very winnable. So, I mean, the one game that seems like the toss-up game is that at Utah. But, you know, if they get through this one, like, is this their second hardest game left after that Utah game? Like, on paper, it might be.
I guess the question is, what's the harder game, at Oregon State, at UCLA? I think at Oregon State is tougher. So I think this is, on paper, tougher. Not to say that UCLA couldn't beat SC, because I think they could. But I think this one looks tougher. I agree.
Yeah, just much less daunting than like some of these SEC West schedules, right? It's just not even in the same league. It's definitely an advantage for these guys. So
yeah, completely agree. All right, well, I think that's going to be a wrap. You got anything else before we go?
I think that covers it. And we'll just hope to keep the streak going in Corvallis this week. So
sounds good. All right. Until next time. Thanks, Nick, and fight on, everyone.
Yep. Yep, fight on.